Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
All right, as promised, we are joined right now by ESPN MLB insider Jeff Passan, joining us on the Sprint People's Hotline. Jeff, good morning. Thanks for coming back on.
Gentlemen, how are you?
Good, man. Let's go. Let's get spring training going in June so we can start on July 1. Let's go. What are we waiting on?
It's that easy, right? What are we waiting on? Okay. Do you actually want me to run down the list of what we're waiting on? I'm not trying to be like the Debbie Downer here, but I think amid all of this, we also need to take a giant pill of reality and acknowledge that July 1st is the same amount of time from now as baseball and basketball shutting down is from now. We're like right in the middle of that moment. And the time between baseball and basketball shutting down and now feels like 11 years. So it's going to potentially feel like another 11 years until opening day happens, if it happens July 1st. And my point, Key, was that look at everything that has happened in that time period. Trying to think that we're not going to have a similarly roller coastery life between now and then, one that could, you know, throw baseball off the tracks. We got to acknowledge that possibility as much as we all do want the game to return.
So, Jeff, with that in mind, when Trevor Plouffe put that date out there, was he just throwing something against the wall? Did he let a cat out of a bag? Where did that come from?
I don't think he was throwing something against the wall. I think that, I don't even know if it was a couple weeks ago. You can see how I've lost track of time. It may have been like a week and change ago at this point. I wrote something saying that at this point, baseball is hoping to get spring training 2.0 started sometime in early to mid-June and have a return in early to mid-July. So that has been out there for a little while, but the actual dates now are being passed along from certain teams to certain players. And one that is pretty frequently mentioned is a June 10th start date for spring training and July 1st start date for the season. It was relayed to the Cleveland Indians in a conference call that they had yesterday with players. And when that specific date is given, it starts breeding hope. Like, okay, now that date was given to the Indians players with the caveat being this is the earliest we're going to come back, not this is when we are coming back. But still, if we're at the point now where teams are telling players that you need to start getting ready, that means that there's going to be a proposal coming down the pike and that there's going to be negotiations between the players and the league in terms of what a return to play protocol looks like. And so we're getting to the nitty gritty here and there's a lot of confidence. Now, is that confidence well placed? Is that confidence rational? We're about to find out.
Jeff, what do you think we learned from South Korea baseball yesterday, besides the fact there's a lot of Americans playing?
I think we learned that baseball, where velocity does not rule, still exists and is actually really enjoyable to watch. I don't know if we learned this, LZ, but I think we were reminded that bat flips are the best and that we need more of them in Major League Baseball. And I think we learned that in a society and in a country where mitigation has worked, and where there is a plan, you can have sports a lot more quickly and easily than a country where there is neither.
Jeff Passan joining us on the Sprint People's Hotline. Jeff, with that in mind, like you said, where velocity is not king when it comes to the pitching, what is the level of play of the KBO? Like, equate it to something we see in American professional baseball. Is it double-A baseball, triple-A baseball, somewhere in between? What is it?
I promise you this is not a cop-out answer, but that's the wrong question to be asking. And I'm not criticizing the question at all because it's a totally reasonable and fair one. Double-A baseball right now has probably 50 to 60% of the pitchers throwing at least 95 and averaging 90, you know, in the bullpen especially, 97-plus. The hardest throwing pitcher in Korea right now tops out at 97. Like, the hardest throwing guy, and he can't throw a strike and doesn't have an off-speed pitch. So I don't want to say that it's a certain level of baseball. I prefer to look at it like it's a certain type of baseball. It is analog baseball still. And what I mean by that is you don't have robust analytics departments in all 10 franchises over there. You don't have players who have geared their swings to be uppercut launch angle type swings, and you don't have this obsession with throwing really hard. And those are the three things that, you can also toss in the defensive shifting, and that kind of plays into the analytics part. But those are the three things that have not happened over there that have had the most profound effect on baseball in 2020. So instead of saying what level they're at, you know, there are major league caliber players over there. And there are guys who wouldn't make it out of A ball as well. So you run the gamut there. But to me, it's not the level of play because there just isn't a consistent one. It's the style of play. And I think it's actually a really enjoyable style of baseball.
Jeff, is there any scenario in which the minor league system could start before the majors because of the smaller towns that they play in?
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be a minor league season this year, to be honest, just because the problem with the minor leagues all comes down to economics, right? You know, these minor league teams make every single cent that they can through gate, through tickets, through concessions, through parking, through sponsorships, through having games with fans at stadiums. And even in the small town where coronavirus, you know, hasn't ravaged these places, it's going to be really tough to get fans back into stadiums and to convince people to go to places where they're going to inherently not be socially distanced. So I think that because of that, the prospect of a minor league season grows increasingly unlikely by the day. And players, I think eventually what's going to happen is when Major League Baseball comes back, it's going to be, you know, a roster of 40 to 50 guys. That's going to include big leaguers and your top minor league players. And they're going to bring their best prospects, you know, not a full camp of guys, but their best prospects out to spring training facilities and essentially run minor league seasons out of there, whether it's with teams that are in their vicinity playing them every day or even running inter-squad games.
Jeff, just switching gears briefly here. If you were doing a show with two African-Americans and you were deciding to pick your favorite car, would you make that pick to General Lee?
Oh, man. Travis, did you do that?
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And not Jeff. Wow. Jeff, not only did I do it, I had the first pick, and I did it.
So, wow.
Yes. I, with the giant and Key wrote me a nice little disclaimer that I put out up front. But when we're talking about iconic – iconic television cars, the General Lee, I feel fine with my pick.
And so I had to, Jeff.
Despite my co-host being African American.
And I had to step up and let him know, despite him picking it, it does not reflect the real Travis Rodgers.
Jeff, you know. And you know that if you have to carry a note everywhere you go, maybe you shouldn't have done what you've done in order to acquire that note to be carried with
you. You know what? That's the surprising part about this is that you're not walking back the pick. When you take Jamarcus Russell, you acknowledge that you made a bad pick, Travis. You took Jamarcus Russell.
No, I did not. I absolutely did not. I feel I'm 100% fine with this pick. And
Travis, the fact that you're 100% confident in the pick means that not only did you take Jamarcus Russell, but you also should be fired as general manager of this terrible fantasy car draft that you are in right now.
Don't worry. Travis figured, hey, they do this in other leagues. Why not, right? They do this in the NFL does it all the time. So
I'm perfectly comfortable with my selections and everything. I don't like Jeff piling on me right now. Let's move along.
Jeff, this is not piling on at all, Travis. This is what you need to hear.
See, no, but I'm gonna be like Michael Jordan.
Me being
cut
a
this
friend
off
right now and telling you that this is not the hill to die on. There are many good hills to die on.
So can I not have my Smokey and the Bandit car either?
Co-host is not the hill, okay?
Thank you, Jeff. Not thank you for your input on the general league, but on all of, on everything else. Appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, sir.
All right, boys. Take care.
Boss Hogg comes with that car, too.
I didn't pick Boss Hogg. Boss Hogg's a bad guy. I picked the car.
When you pick the car, you get Boss Hogg with it.
There are so many things about that show that when you're 10 years old, you just don't even understand what's going on. And perhaps the two things that come together is that the bad guy was named Boss Hogg and he wore all white.
I had no idea what was going on. I had a General Lee car running across the carpet. So,
see, why didn't you tell him passing that key?
Well, that's because y'all made it feel it was okay. I had no idea. Y'all taught me that was okay.
Yeah. I honestly had no idea what the stars and bars even was at that point in my life. I didn't
is
know.
It on the, is it on the front of the hood or on the side doors?
It's on the roof.
It's on the roof.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. It's on the roof. And it's a bad look. It is a bad look for sure.
Find that sound for me, Jorge, the music. You need to bring Travis back in on that one.
Well, we will definitely do that. Plus, Charles Barkley says that he's still, 20 years after offering some criticism of the way he was running his team, they are still not good. We'll get into that. That's coming up next on The Morning Show on 710 ESPN. I feel like I'm being ganged up on here. I don't like it.
You made the pick.
That's true.
Out the gate.
That's what the guy in San Diego said at the supermarket. I feel like y'all are ganging up on me.
Yeah, no, my head was uncovered when I made the pick, so I'm not like the guy in San Diego. I'm feeling all right about that.
But real talk, though, this is a great song. it's a really good song.
It's Waylon Jennings, right?
Yeah. It's a really good song.
TV doesn't have theme songs like this anymore.
You know, it's so funny. So I was in a conference call yesterday with the television team for the LA Times because we're working on some Emmy stuff. Oh. And I was like, it's so strange to have these great shows without memorable theme songs. Because in TV's heyday, you had mediocre shows with fantastic theme songs. Mm. And I wish we could blend these two things together.
Yeah. Boys. Cooter.
Cooter was the mechanic.
Yeah. Cooter, Boss Hogg. What was the other dude?
Roscoe P. Cotrain.
Cute.
Yeah, and then his deputy was Enos.
Enos.
Yeah, and then Bo and Luke and Daisy and Uncle Jesse. That's the show.
Daisy and Uncle Jesse. I like Uncle Jesse. Uncle Jesse was cool. He felt like he was with us, but I don't know.
I don't know about that.
I don't know.
That's what I said. I don't know, but he felt like he would be with us and cool with us. Like if we was, you know, walking, he'd be like, nah, leave him alone type. He seemed like he was that dude.
Did you see the roof of that car key?
No, I understand that, but he just seemed like he wanted to keep the peace.
Yeah, maybe. He just wanted to get his shine, right? He just wanted to run his moonshine and live his life, and Boss Hogg was messing with him. It's a great show. Little dated, but a great show nonetheless. All right. Last Dance episodes 7 and 8 coming up on Sunday, 6 o'clock. You can check that out, ESPN, the ESPN app. You can get caught up on 1 through 6 on the ESPN app and ESPN On Demand as well. And then, so we've been talking more Michael Jordan in the last 3 weeks than we probably have in the last couple of years combined, for sure. Yesterday, Charles Barkley went on the radio in Chicago and talked about how his relationship with Michael Jordan came to an end and how it still has not been repaired nearly 20 years later.
The thing that bothered me the most about that whole thing, I don't think that I said anything that bad.
No.
Because I'm pretty sure I said, hey, as much as I love Michael, until he stopped hiring them kiss asses and his best friends, he's never going to be successful as a general manager. And I remember I'm pretty much verbatim I said that. And the thing that's really pissed me off about it later is Phil Jackson said the exact same thing. And I'm like, no, man, if you're going to be – because, listen, when you're famous, and Michael at one point was the most famous person in the world, everybody around you is either on the payroll or letting you buy drinks and dinner and flying around on your private jet. Very few of your friends are going to be honest with you. And that's very hard – for any celebrity, but especially somebody of his stature. But I thought that was one of the reasons we were great friends. Like, I can ask Charles anything, and I know he's going to give me a straight answer. But part of my job is, because I can't go on TV and say another general manager sucks, and then just because Michael's like a brother to me, say he's doing a fantastic job. That would be disingenuous.
Well, Charles is right. Charles is right about all of that. I think it just it hurt Michael to a core because, you know, their friendship was so deep that he didn't realize that Charles would go and criticize him, and then everybody else would follow Charles as Charles set that up. Charles said what he believed, and everybody else just started piling on, and it made it seem as though, you know, it was like it was harsh. It made it worse. And so I could certainly see how Barkley feels, but I also could see how Michael felt in that instance in terms of, okay, I've been with you, we've been rolling together for a long time, you get on TV, and now you say something, you know, critical of me, but Michael has to understand also that that's Chuck's job. His job is to be critical or praise or whatever the case may be, because if he was saying he was doing a fabulous job, they'd still be smoking cigars together.
Mm-hmm.
It is so weird to see people of that particular stature, like a Michael Jordan, and see them have this one particular character flaw, which is the grudges, the pettiness.
But is that a character flaw, though, LZ? Is that a character flaw?
I would say most people would assume someone who's constantly being petty as that would be a character flaw.
But is that petty too? I mean, you use descriptions and describing it. Well, Michael Jordan's behavior or approaches things. I wouldn't call it a character flaw, and I wouldn't call it petty. I would call it something that this is how this man feels. He feels that you didn't protect him and you said certain things. He just doesn't understand that that's your job to do. The fact that he doesn't deal with Isaiah Thomas, because he feels that whatever Isaiah did or made him feel a certain way or didn't shake his hand or whatever the case may be, that has nothing to do with it. Character flaw. There's people that you don't like that you don't speak to. I'm sure there is. We all have those in our life.
I think there's a couple of things going on. What makes Michael is that everything is looked at binary, that you're either with him or against him. You either are going to help him or you're not. You're either going to help him win a championship or you're not. And that's what makes him, that everything is looked at through that lens, makes Michael Jordan Michael Jordan. But I think as far as just, and again, I'll put on my amateur psychologist hat here, to be a person that lives for the 20 years with these grudges that you can never let go, yeah, it's a character flaw. It's a tough way to go through where you can't have anybody in your life tell you the truth. I mean, look, nobody likes to hear criticism. Nobody's like, cool, tell me more about the things you don't like about me or the things that I do wrong. This is great. Keep it coming. But you need it. And intellectually, you understand that you need it. And if you just cut out, and he's got the means and the resources and the fame and all these things to just just cut anybody that he hears that's even mildly critical of him loose? I can't imagine that's a great way to go through your day every day for the next 50 years.
But we only know that instance, right? We only know what Chuck said. We don't know everything. It could have been some other stuff that was there that festered. We don't know. We only know this one thing.
That is true. That is true. We don't know. But what I do know as a writer, and any writer who's worked their weight in salt would tell you this, that you need a good editor. You don't need a cheerleader.
Why are you telling me?
You don't need a cheerleader. You need a good editor. You need someone who's going to look at your copy and give you constructive criticism. Say, this doesn't make sense, this doesn't work, blah, 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 blah. That's how you become better. And if you're not able to handle that criticism, you're not going to be a very good writer. And so when it comes to running a team, if you can't handle criticism from somebody that you trust, and I'm assuming he trusted Charles Barkley, then what are we doing here? Like, what do you want? You're not winning, and someone that you trust is telling you why you're not winning, and your answer to that, at least from this one perspective, is
but
to cut that person out.
He's telling me on television, not in private. So,
but you know the key. That's do you think that he hadn't said that to him privately?
Because I'm sure he had, but what I'm saying is you're telling me in the public. You're telling me so other people can jump on as well. What we talked about in private, you didn't need to take it to the streets. And I think that is probably one of the things that Michael is offended about and said, you know what, you burned me in the public, so I won't even deal with you. I think I don't know this for a fact. I'm only guessing, right, in this situation because it was public. And you say, well, do you think he ever said that to him in private? Absolutely. I'm sure Charles told him in private. Charles said he told him before. Like, man, you got all these dudes hanging around you for nothing.
Yeah, you know, it's just it's a weird deal. But I think what's really interesting is that, you know, as these episodes air, we're seeing more and more of Michael's contemporaries pipe up from a variety of different angles, but they all seem to be hurt. Like, everybody seemed to get some hurt. Like, Mike's broken a lot of hearts for a lot of different reasons. And it's just interesting watching these guys come out.
I wouldn't say that. Because Magic didn't feel that way. Certainly, B.J. Armstrong didn't feel that way. Kerr didn't feel that way. Well, head coach Jackson didn't feel that way. The only people felt that way is the Detroit Pistons, and that's it that I could think of. And now,
but to Charles's point,
Charles Barkley,
Phil Jackson,
I said Charles Barkley, and I said Charles Barkley, the Pistons, and Charles Barkley.
And we just talked about
that way.
And we just talked about Charles Oakley.
And yeah, but Oak didn't feel that way. Oak is his dude. Oak didn't feel that way. Oak ain't talking nothing negative about Barkley.
Let me try this again. These shows have gotten people opening up and talking about the hurt. I didn't say Mike hurt Charles Oakley, but right. Charles Oakley has opened up about the hurt caused by Mike because this show is not airing. That's my point. Not that Mike is hurting all these cats, is that some of these old heads are being reminded of how they felt or things that went wrong or et cetera.
I'm glad you corrected yourself, sir.
I didn't correct myself. I misunderstood what I said.
Why does Charles Barkley get exiled where Phil Jackson offers roughly the same criticism and he does not suffer any consequences?
Because he's the head coach, one, and we don't know if Michael's relationship with Phil outside of being a coach was the same as it was with Barkley outside of basketball. I've never seen Michael Jordan hanging out with Phil Jackson outside of basketball. So maybe that's your answer.
Or maybe to Key's point, maybe there's some other things that happened and that was the final straw.
That's the best explanation of all, that maybe there's more to it than Charles is letting on. But, you know, Charles is, for all the criticism you can aim his way, he's a pretty honest guy. He's a pretty transparent guy. If there was something else, maybe I just feel like Charles would have offered it up. And so we'll continue the conversation. And you just mentioned Charles Oakley as well. Charles Oakley says the reason that they couldn't get past the Bulls is because of Patrick Ewing. We'll discuss that next on The Morning Show on 710 ESPN.
Though we're apart these days, we're sharing more. So at GEICO, we'd like to say thanks. Thanks for sharing your savage dance moves. Thanks for sharing your DIY haircut fails. Thanks for sharing your inner lip sync star. Now, it's our turn to share with the GEICO Give Back, a 15% credit on car and motorcycle policies for current and new customers. Because we're committed for the long haul, the 15% credit lasts your full policy term. Visit geico.com/giveback for more info and eligibility.
You inspired him, LZ.
Yo, man, she's got me thinking. She's got me in my feelings right now. These new pictures of Adele. Happy birthday, by the way, to Adele, one of the greatest singers of this generation. She's floating on the internet, guys, and she's looking slimmer and fiercer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's put in some work, clearly.
What do you mean by that, Travis?
Exercise. What else could it mean?
It could have gone different ways, man.
It could have gone a variety of different ways. No, she looks great. I just wonder now what kind of music she's going to do. Because I've always been the person who believes that, particularly when it comes to music, the artists that sing from pain just seem to have better content. So her first couple records, she was like really, really good coming from pain. And now she's looking fierce and happy. And, you know, she's dating again and she's feeling sexy. I just don't want the music to be all happy and stuff now.
All right. So talk about getting into your feelings, right? You'd mentioned the guys of the 80s and 90s are all talking in this documentary, amongst them Charles Oakley, who was talking about their inability to get past the Jordan Bulls of the 90s. And he put the blame on Patrick Ewing. What he said was, quote, "Patrick, at the end of the game, he'd get double teamed. He'd shoot fadeaways on double teams, and that hurt us as a team. My thing with Jordan is, it's not like you beat us by 20. Most games went down to 2-3 possessions. Y'all made shots. We didn't. The best player won. Michael was a better player than Patrick, hands down."
See, you don't need to do all that, though. He cutting to the white meat on that. Just leave that alone, man. You don't need to say Michael was a better player than Patrick, hands down. Just leave that alone. We all know what Michael was versus Patrick Ewing. Like, that sound like some personal, just a personal attack right there. That's when you start talking about personal stuff, LZ, that's personal.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely that's personal. But we don't know what their background is. We don't know if they had a big falling out when he went to Seattle. We don't know any of that stuff. But what we do know is that there have certainly been some moments in Patrick Ewing's career, starting at Georgetown, where that dude MJ has haunted him. And out of all of his rivals, you got to think, because it started, you know, in college and then obviously through the pros, that of all his rivals, it's Patrick Ewing who suffered the most.
Is it too? I mean, because let's kind of analyze this on the word choice here. The fact that he's describing the fadeaways, does that make it different? Because to say that Michael Jordan's a better player than Patrick Ewing is not terribly groundbreaking. Of course he is. The sentence, "Michael Jordan is a better basketball player than blank," is accurate almost without exception. Right. But the fact that you're talking about Patrick Ewing, who was what, 7'1", whatever he was. I mean, he was a big dude, a physical dude, and was a guy that was an absolute dominant presence in the NBA at that time. The fact that he mentions the fadeaways, is that not kind of a, "Hey, dude, you're a 7-footer, get in the paint and do your thing. What are you doing shooting fadeaways?"
No, I wouldn't say that, because that was his shot. You know, Hakeem Olajuwon was shake and bake off a dude that was still 6'8", because that's just how he got into his rhythm for his shot. Hakeem Olajuwon shot fadeaways over guys who were shorter too. He was just better at shooting the fadeaways. Kareem shot sky hooks regardless who was guarding him. Kareem could have just dunked on somebody, but the sky hook was his shot. So for Patrick Ewing, you know, the fadeaway was like his go-to move. It was like his money shot. I don't take that as a slight against him in terms of his physicality. I do, however, think that mentioning that he didn't pass the ball in those situations meant that he was trying to have a contest with Michael, and Michael won that contest.
Key, do you think there's something there about the fadeaways?
I understand what LZ is saying, but I also understand what – I think I understand what Oak is saying. You're trying to fade away with the double team instead of fighting through the double team and playing big like you should be playing. So it could be either way. At the end of the day, my focus point is really on him calling him out and terms of Michael is better, hands down. That's where I kind of, you know, disagree with Oakley on as far as that go. But, again, there may be some underlining thing there where their relationship went south and, you know, it's at a different level now.
LZ, like you were saying, it is funny to see. I mean, here we are. We're in 2020. We're talking about games that were played in the 1990s. And these guys are all taking turns sniping each other. I mean, yeah. it's been 25 years, and here we are. I'll tell you why we lost to Michael Jordan, because Patrick Ewing wouldn't pass the ball and kept shooting damn fadeaways. It's like it happened last week.
I mean,
it's still just wrong.
Because these dudes had battles, and it's blood, sweat, and tears. And so we're watching The Last Dance, and we're being reminded what it felt like as we were growing up and coming to our own as men. But they're watching it, being reminded of all the pain. Isaiah Thomas is looking, and he's being reminded of the pain. Plus, he got called out. Charles Oakley is thinking, man, we went up 2-0 on this squad, and then they went 4 straight, and we get bounced. So he's being reminded of this stuff, and so the emotions of it all comes out. I mean, it makes sense to me, but at the same time, it is still funny that every episode there just seems to be somebody who's got something to say, because Jordan, either directly or indirectly, then touched the nerve through this documentary.
Well, there might not be anybody in the history of sports who's been better at touching nerves than Michael Jordan. I mean, we talk about him being the greatest basketball player of all time. He might have been the greatest, you know, blank talker of all time.
That's still Ali.
Boxing's in a different category, because that's expected of Bob. This is something that, and it's not just, I mean, I get Joe Frazier aside. We know how that plays out. But this is
Ali would talk about your mama before a fight.
The way that Michael Jordan would go at guys, like we just said, we're talking 30 years later, and guys are still like, they remember what was said. We're talking about Clyde Drexler the other day, where the guys on the Dream Team had to go to him and say, dude, take it easy, man. He's on our team for this thing. You got to lighten up on him. That Michael was relentless with that stuff. Ali was great at it, but it felt like a lot of it was for the show, for the salesmanship. That Jordan was just brutal.
Yeah, but it Jordan's is different. Everybody trash talks are different. I mean, it just depends. You know, whether it's Prime, whether it was me, whether it's Mike, everybody's is different depending on the person that you're dealing with. You know, I may gut somebody that I can't stand I'm playing against. Or I might clown somebody that I don't like that I'm playing against. Or I might tease that person. Or I might tease my teammate or clown my team. It's just different. Trash talking is different depending on the person.
You would tailor it to the whoever it was aimed at.
Yeah,
because absolutely. It doesn't sound
and that's
like
the same thing. And that's
Michael.
The same thing. Michael's doing the same thing. He's tailoring it to where it's aimed at. Like when he tells the security guard to get out, and it go security calling security on security. That's trash talking, but he's doing that out of fun. When he talks about Clyde Drexler, for instance, like he ain't really trash talking Clyde. He's just telling you what his thought process is. What he went through and said, man, that dude ain't me. Y'all tripping. That's basically what he was saying when he gave us that on the sit-down interview. He's not trash-talking Clyde Drexler. He's just explaining to us his mentality and his thought process going up against Clyde.
All right. We've watched Jordan through the first 6 episodes. We've got 4 more to go, a 10-part series. Which documentary would you rather see coming up next? Would you rather see the Mike Tyson story or the Tiger Woods story? That's straight ahead on The Morning Show on 710 ESPN. So The Last Dance has been the smash hit that everybody was hoping it would be. It's been great television for the last several weeks. We got 4 more episodes to go. But, you know, fast forward a couple of weeks, we're going to be done with The Last Dance, and we're going to be looking for the next thing. Let me set this up like this, because I think there's an important distinction here. Let's assume that you're going to get the best out of both of these subjects, that both of these men would be as transparent as they could possibly be. Would you rather see a similar documentary on the life, career, and out of the ring Mike Tyson, or the life, career, and out of the golf course Tiger Woods, assuming that both of these guys are going to tell you what they know?
I'm going with Mike. I don't want to see nothing about Tiger. I mean, Tiger, they make it and it comes out great. I watch it, but it's not one that I'm going to sit at home and set my clock to go and see. Mike Tyson, on the other hand, yes, because that's more – that identifies more with in line with who I am, mm-hmm. my upbringing, that sort of stuff. Tiger is kind of – I mean, I kind of – you know, to a degree, I already kind of know somewhat of the interesting parts of the Waffle House, or not Waffle House. What was it?
Perkins.
I mean, okay, so I learned a little bit about Perkins. I get a girl on there who says that I met Tiger. He sat at my table. He gave me his number after he paid his check, and we hung out for a few weeks. Da 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 da. I mean, that's not interesting to me.
Okay, Key, let me stop you right there, because I tend to agree with you on that part of it, that his relationships outside of his marriage, okay, we know that it was numerous and whatever, but the part that he's never talked about and the part that I'm fascinated by is how all of that affected his ability to perform his sport, because Tiger Woods was unlike anybody else we've ever seen play golf. It was just totally, completely different. That happened, and he just cratered. It took him over 10 years to figure out how to play golf again. And I know part of it was physical, but you could never convince me that it was entirely physical. That the being embarrassed and put out like that, the way that he was, a guy that was private and just absolutely obsessed with his own image, that it went the way that it did. I don't care how many women he had relationships with. I care how the relationships and the public exposure of that affected his life, because his life came apart for 10 years. The drugs, the cars, all of that stuff. I mean, you would have never thought that was going to happen to Tiger.
I care about the number of women he slept with. I want to see a whole segment, a whole show dedicated to just interviewing one after another, after another, after another. I'm fascinated as to how Tiger Woods, someone that we consider to be quite corny, how did he go about approaching these women? What were the conversations like?
Yeah, but one, none of them, really was only like? One of them that was cool looking. Out of all of them, it was the one that was in New York. The rest of them.
The eye is in the beholder, Key.
Yeah, but no, it's in my eyes. I'm telling you right now. It's in my eyes. Raj? You
know, yeah, one and a half.
One out of all of them.
I don't know what a dude got a million dollars
was doing.
Whether or not you found his mistresses attractive is not the topic. Okay.
Yes, it is. Oh, yes, it is. That's all part of it, Travis, because I'm really curious as to how this dude stepped to these women, because when I hear him talk, he sounds like the corniest thing that's ever opened his mouth and used the English language. So I'm just
curious. But look, the thing is, though, LZ, not that he's corny or anything. I mean, it's Tiger, right? It's Tiger. He doesn't need to say anything.
Exactly.
It's Tiger.
I understand he doesn't need to say anything, but he still had to say something.
Yeah, you guys,
but it doesn't matter. That whatever language he's speaking, they're gonna translate that to whatever they need to translate it to be a part of Tiger's crew. That's just what it is. If he's sounding like he's straight from Stanford, Harvard, and Yale all mixed together, they're gonna figure out how to make it work.
Well, no. Then there's the Mike piece of it, because Mike, quite honestly, Mike's kind of an open book at this point in his life. Mike will tell you about all the things that he's been through and around, and then Mike's athletic career is fascinating as well. I'd rather hear Tiger, but Mike would actually tell you what happened. I think.
But not only Mike, though, the people they're going to interview to talk about Mike is what you want.
Yes.
You want the Roys and the Roy Holloway,
John Horn, Roy Holloway.
You want those guys talking to you about the night in question. You want them talking about when he was at the club, what he did. You want that because they're going to bring that excitement to the documentary, opposed to somebody at Tiger's camp. Well, you know, Tiger went out on the 18th hole, and when we got down to Augusta. Like,
but, Keith, here's the thing. What you just described, I don't know who that is. Tiger's a lot like Jordan. He doesn't have guys.
That guy that you say who that is, That's the guy who's carrying his bag, or that's the guy who works at Nike, or that's the guy. Those are the ones that you're going to hear from. You're going to hear from those. I don't want to hear from corporate people, corporate sponsors. Well, we did a deal with Tiger.
That's why
I don't want to hear that.
That's why I think Tiger is the more interesting subject, because we know all the people around Mike Tyson. We know who they are. You just mentioned a bunch of their names. When it comes to Tiger, he had guys that he kept at a distance, but nobody was on the inside. Nobody.
No, they were on the inside, but they wasn't saying anything.
There was
guys on the inside. No, okay. When you say guys, right, he didn't have 30 posse members, but he had his couple little buddies that he hang out with, and those were the guys that knew, but they turned their head the other way because it wasn't. They want to make sure that they could still ride on the private jet to Augusta, go up to Pebble Beach, hang out in Reno. Those are a few handful. I don't want to hear from them. I don't want to hear from the marketing director at Nike. I don't want to hear from that guy. I don't want to hear from the coach at Stanford golf team. I don't want to. I want to hear from the dude from Brooklyn that seen Tyson. No, real talk. I want to hear from the dude from Brooklyn that seen Tyson grow up at 16 years old and seen this.
This is my point. We're saying the same thing, Keith. My point is this: is I agree with you that you would get
personality
executives.
Man.
I get. There aren't those people, the personalities that you're talking about, the guy from Brooklyn, for instance, right? That person in Tiger's world doesn't exist. I want to know why that doesn't exist, why no one was able to get close, why nobody has that story about those guys. That's what makes Tiger more interesting to me, is because it's all mystery.
I want to know why Perkins. Why not Red Lobster? Why not Olive Garden? Like, I want to know that.
He's in the mood for pancakes.
Who knows?
I had a few everywhere from the looks of it. I mean, you just
when
never know.
When we first met Tiger, he was such a great guy.
Not
we
those guys.
Him up.
Not those guys. All right, Damian Woody joined us earlier today. We were talking about Cam Newton and whether or not he should take a seat for a year or at least wait for somebody to go down, or he should accept a backup role. That's coming up next on The Morning Show on 710 ESPN.